Today we're going to talk about confinement. And basically try and use ADS-CFT to compute confinement in QCD and see what interesting things we can say. So I'll start by talking about what is confinement. Afterwards, we're going to try and use ADS-CFT to compute things having to do with confinement, so a mass gap, the spectrum of masses, and so on. But now our ADS-CFT normally is between n equal 4 superyang mils and ADS, and n equal 4 superyang mils is not a confining theory. So we need to do something on this gauge side to turn that into a confining theory. So we're going to start with the CFT side and talk about that. And so whatever we do on that side, we're going to have to do something similar on the gravity side. So that'll be the next step. We'll talk about what it is we do on the ADS side so that we can compute all these nice quantities. And then we can actually compare some of our results with numerical data in Lattice QCD and see if what we do on ADS-CFT actually makes any sense. Okay, so what is confinement? Right, so it's a strong coupling effect. And it's what makes sure that the asymptotic states in QCD are not the quarks and the gluons and everything that we're used to be, but rather they're hadrons or glue balls or big collections of all these massless fields, and they join up together and they become the asymptotic states of our theory. Right? So the real eigenstates of our Hamiltonians are not these quarks and these gluons that we're used to working with and that we do our expansions with, but rather all these other particles that are the hadrons, and we don't know all that much about those guys. So one way to talk about confinement is to say that there's some potential V of R between our particles, which is proportional to the distance between these particles. So I've got two gluons, they have a potential which is linear. So that means if the two gluons are very far apart, they need to have an energy which is infinite so that they can exist. So as this says, is that we don't have any asymptotic states in our theory. You can't have just a free gluon walking around. So no free gluons. There's two properties that are important. The first one is that we'll have a mass gap. So this means that we don't have any massless state in our theory. If you look for the lowest mass state, it's going to be at some gap away from zero. So this happens because you don't have any free gluon states. So your first state is going to be a bunch of gluons stuck together in a bound state. It's going to have some binding energy. And so this is going to have some non-zero mass. And we also expect that there be a discrete spectrum for the masses in our theory, again, depending on how all these gluons stick together to make some big glue ball, that's going to affect our mass spectrum. All right, so basically, if you can prove that your theory has a mass gap, then you prove that there's confinement, because we're starting with some massless degrees of freedom. So you're proving that gluons are not asymptotic states. And so I'm just repeating myself a lot here just to make it clear. So that means there's no long-range force which propagates at the speed of light. And so it means that the force is short range. So right now, all we know about, or at least most of what we know about confinement in QCD comes from numerical results. So it's all mostly from lattice QCD. So you put your QCD on a lattice and you do numerical computations, and then you see, okay, it looks to be confined, a strong coupling, and all these things actually seem to be true. And then if you can do a rigorous proof of this confinement, it's one of the Millennium Prizes from the Clay Institute. So at least some people seem to think this is something important, something nice. Yes? Yeah, but see, if you look at the first equality, then if you prove that there's a mass gap, there's confinement. So that's why Witten got to convince all these fancy people that proving a mass gap in young males was an interesting mathematical problem, because it has something to do with confinement and QCD. Of course, the prize is more complicated, because the first step is you want to prove that gauge theories exist, which is not trivial. Okay, so this is hard and interesting. So whenever you have a hard and interesting problem, you start doing ADS-CFT. All right, so we have this duality. We have some gauge theory on one side. We have some gravity theory on the other side. And right off the bat, there's a big problem, because what we want to use is the duality between N equal 4 super young males and ADS. But that just doesn't sound very good, because N equal 4 super young males, well, supersymmetric, it's conformally invariant, and it's not confining. So it really doesn't have any of the properties that we care about in QCD. So that's not good. And well, ADS is just ADS. So basically, the plan is we have super young males, and so we erase the supersymmetry by doing something to the geometry. Right? So we break supersymmetry, we break conformal invariance, and then this is going to become a nice young males theory, hopefully. Now here, when we break supersymmetry and conformal invariance, we're going to do that by doing something to our geometry. And so we're going to change the asymptotic geometry of our ADS to be something else. And so here, we're going to get some new dual gravity theory. And then we're going to use this duality over here. And we're going to compare some numerical results with lattice QCD. So that's the plan. Does anyone have any questions? Yes? No, I didn't say what I'm going to do, but I will soon. I'm doing something.
I missed you, not
say that. Okay. All right, so let's go ahead. And the first step of the story is we have N equal 4 super young males. I want to turn that into something that looks kind of like young males, or is as close as possible to young males. So first of all, we want to break conformal invariance. So obviously, that's the first problem. Super young males is conformally invariant. QCD is not conformally invariant. So we need to take care of this. So we're going to compactify one of our dimensions, just like good old Kaluza Klein. So we start with our theory on R3, 1. And then we're going to move to R 2,1 cross S1. And this thing is going to have some radius R, and that's going to be the new scale that we're throwing into our problem to break conformal invariance. So now we have a new theory on R2,1 process 1 with some radius r. We're no longer conformally invariant, but we're still supersymmetric, so that's definitely not Yang-Mills. So part B, we want to break supersymmetry. So the way we do this, we want to do all our things geometrically just so that it makes sense with ADS. So what we're going to do is on this circle that we just introduced, we're going to give different boundary conditions on bosons and on fermions. So we introduce supersymmetry baking boundary condition on this Kaluza-Klein circle. And what we want is we want the bosons to be periodic. And we want the fermions to be anti-periodic. So let's see what this does for us. So this has a few good consequences for us. So first of all, the fermions gain a mass. So we have this Kaluza-Klein tower that we just built. And if you have scalars, or if you just do your normal Kaluza-Klein tower, you have all these states that show up. But the first state is massless. You have this n equals 0 state that doesn't really do anything. If you have anti-periodic boundary conditions, then that state's gone. So if I have some field phi, yeah.
Sorry, so do you impose that they have those boundary conditions, or do they just have it?
I impose it with an iron fist. So if I have a field phi, and you know it obeys some type of Klein-Gorn equation when it goes around the circle, so I look at the mode around my Klein-Gorn part. So if I want to look at the massless fermion mode, I have this d squared phi equals 0. And then, well, this is just going along a circle, so this doesn't actually have any anti-periodic solutions. Right? So I'm just saying the second derivative of phi in some direction is 0, so that means phi is some is linear in y, and that can't be anti-periodic. So what you find is that you don't have your zero mode in your Kaluza-Klein anymore in your tower. So your first fermion has a mass. It has to go around the circle and do something. Great. Also, right, the mass of the fermion is going to have to be of order 1 over r just because that's the only scale we have in the problem. So automatically, if I make this r to be very small, then my fermions are going to be very massive, and so I can project them out. So I started with my n equal 4 super Yang-Mills, and by playing with my energy scales properly, I can get rid of all my fermions. So I'm one step closer to just Yang-Mills. All right, now the scalars also get a mass. Yes.
Did you understand what he just explained about fermions getting a mass?
Well, it's Kaluza-Klein towers, and their mass are proportional to the radius, 1 over the radius. But I don't understand why you can't have zero mass.
So, I mean, the equation I just wrote, I mean, you're using, I mean, this is not some abstract index mu, and I'm not doing like, this is not the wave equation which would have all these solutions. This is really just saying that phi is a plus b times y. So normally your first Kaluza-Klein, your first mode along the circle is just a constant.
Yeah.
you just say phi is equal to whatever along the circle, and if it's periodic, then that's fine. But if my field is a constant, then he can't be antiperiodic because he's a constant, and therefore that doesn't exist.
I mean, another way of saying is, if usually in, when I'm doing Kaluza client, well, talking about these Kaluza client towers, what you're doing is you have your field. It does whatever it does in the open space, but you do a Fourier, you know, you decompose into Fourier modes on the circle. If phi is a periodic field, then, you know, you if you like, you do it in terms of whatever sines or cosines of 2 pi x over r. And one of the choices, or well, there was an integer in there. One of the choices is it doesn't vary at all. But he's saying that when I go around the circle, I start at one value here, I come back to the negative value here. And so it had to do something in the middle. And so in fact, if you look in more detail at the Fourier decomposition, now it would be integers plus a half. Kind of like when we were doing, you know, Ramon versus Nevis-Schwarz fields on the, but what that means is that since it's integers plus a half, then zero isn't one of the eigenvalues anymore, or it isn't. So the masses are, all have to be something, non-vanishing. That, I don't know that I did any better, but.
Is everything clear for everyone?
I probably don't know something about Souvarian things, but why compactification breaks conformal invariants? I mean, we do have conformal theorism in the cylinder, for example.
I mean, you can take a conformal field theory and stick it into interesting background. I think what we're thinking here is we have a four-dimensional theory, it's conformal. I compactify the cylinder, and then I ask, what is the theory that's left over in the three dimension?
So basically I'm taking the radius here to be small. So the theory that I care about, what's going to become the QCD that I like, is the one that's really just living on R2 comma 1 plus some new scale R, which comes from the circle, but I kind of forgot where it came from at some point.
So the circle has naturally given us a scale.
Yeah. I mean, also from the fermion's mass.
I get that.
So, I mean, you'll be considering QCD and three dimensions, more or less.
Yes.
Right. So, if you
proved
mass gap in three dimensions, would that be enough to prove mass gap in four dimensions?
Mm-hmm. Probably not. But it would certainly be very, depends what you mean by prove. But you can do the same game to get the four-dimensional QCD. I'll talk a bit about this at the end.
But
it's just a different
concept. Let's distinguish the words QCD from Yang-Mills. Because QCD is a theory with gluons and quarks. He's going to claim that we get a theory that just has gluons in it.
When I say QCD, I mean pure Yang-Mills with no quarks, and I'm abusing notation. So I'll probably keep doing the mistake. So.
Well, I thought you were actually being, you know, you wrote Yang-Mills. You keep saying Yang-Mills.
I'm very good at these things.
Okay.
right, so scalars. So they gain mass. So at tree level, so if you just do your closed client stuff with your scalars, you have the zero mode, so they don't get a mass. So you might think, oh, my scalars are massless. But then you start to renormalize them, and you look at your one-loop propagator. Would say the fermion, so I'm going to have something that looks like a propagator here, plus a one loop with some fermions in the middle. And then you calculate this, so you get this, your 1 over p squared propagator. And then you get 1 over p squared times something I'm going to call capital sigma, because Peskin calls it capital sigma, times 1 over p squared. And then there's a bunch of other loop terms later. And then you say, well, that kind of looks like a geometric series. And so this is approximately 1 over p squared minus sigma. Hopefully that's familiar to everyone. So you find some effective mass squared, which looks like sigma, which is this amputated loop diagram. And then you say, well, this has a g squared from my two vertices. There's a color loop that runs inside. So this, the fat graph looks like that. So there's an n in the middle. And then the integral of this thing looks like k slash minus m, k slash minus k slash minus m has dimension of energy squared. All right, so these are two fermions, so I get 1 over k, 1 over k. There's the k cube in my integral, so I'm integrating k, get k squared. And so I expect this whole thing to look like mass squared, so I'm going to have some 1 over r squared over here. So I get this to be more or less the mass of my scalar. So they get a mass. OK. I'm about to do the bosons. I don't know who you're talking about.
Okay, well, I could have drawn that diagram.
In n equal 4. That's probably going to be, it's going to be the same reason why my gauge bosons don't get a mass right now. Okay. So,
well, okay.
More or less. Did you have? All right, and then I look at my gauge bosons. And they don't acquire a mass thanks to the magic of gauge invariance. So if we draw some, there's this gauge guy, there's going to be some fermion loop. And I put some indices mu and nu. So this diagram is going to be epsilon mu star times something I'm going to call time you knew. Yeah?
Well, don't the scalars then, by that reasoning, related to the inverse of the radius? I'm a bit confused. Why wouldn't the loops give you mass in the compacted five?
What do you mean, here? I imagine it's a Ward identity with supersymmetry. So my guess is you're going to be subtracting a Gauss diagram from supersymmetry. Does that make sense? I mean, yeah.
You had not broken supersymmetry, I don't think you would.
Yeah, well, I have all these.
If you had compactified, I don't think it would have been correct.
Right, because I mean, I have other diagrams I didn't write. Like,
right.
There's, if I have supersymmetry, there's a Gauss diagram for one, which would be very important here. But in this case, like a super. Well, like a supersymmetric Gauss, no? Maybe not.
No, this isn't. There's no local supersymmetry. There are ghosts for the gauge symmetry.
Oh.
Maybe I'm not. I mean, there's that I pop up ghosts for the gauge theory part of it. But supersymmetry is just a global. Well, actually, I don't know. Do you have to? not sure how to interpret that or parse that, that word, but I think that you, an important feature here is we've introduced the scale R, we've broken supersymmetry. When you break supersymmetry, there's basically no reason the scalars can't, the mass can't be renormalized. And R, the scale R naturally feeds in through these loops that Alex told us about because it's in the mass of the all of the fermionic mode. Basically, it's the only scale in the problem, so it had to show up there when we needed a scale.
Happy? Okay, so here we use our Ward identity that Q times this pi zero. So this pi mean nu is just the loop integral that I have here. So basically the steps I'm doing right now is exactly the same steps that you do in QED. If you calculate, say, the photon propagator, you find it doesn't have a renormalized mass. Exactly the same thing that we're doing here. So if Q mu times pi mu nu is zero, then your pi mu nu has to look like G mu nu minus Q mu Q nu over Q squared, because those are my only two tensors, times some function of Q squared. And after you do all this, if you calculate your one loop propagator, so you have your two diagrams, you get something like minus I G mu nu over Q squared times 1 minus pi of Q squared. And so this has a pole at Q squared equals 0, and so this is still a massless particle. Right, so we started, we had our enclosed spam mill, we have our gauge field, our fermions, and our photon, our scalars. And so these guys have mass 1 over, which looks like 1 over R, whereas our gauge boson remains massless. And so I can project these out by just looking at the low energy state, or by setting R to zero. And essentially, I have a theory where I only have a bunch of gauge bosons here, and that looks like Yang-Mills. Okay, are we happy with the field theory story? So we started with super Yang-Mills, we did this compactification on a circle, put some antiperiodic boundary conditions, and magically anything that was not part of Yang-Mills theory just vanished, which was very convenient. So the next step is we want to find the ADS geometry that's dual whatever geometry we have. So normally you have super Yang-Mills on flat space, you have ADS 5. Now our boundary for bulk theory won't just be flat space, because we come back by one of our directions. And so we're looking for something that's asymptotically ADS. And we want the boundary to be just R 2 comma 1 crosses 1. So we have a few options here. What we do, so the first naive thing you could do is say, okay, well, I'm just going to start with vacuum ADS and compactify one direction. So you have all these different spacetimes, and they're all going to contribute different numbers to your path integral. They're all different saddle points. And turns out this naive one is not the best saddle point. So to think about what kind of spacetimes we actually want, we're going to start with a black brain metric. So that's some black band metric. It has some temperature. The reason we want to start with this is because we will know, I think, next lecture, that n equal 4 super Young males at high temperature is confining. And so you might think, OK, well, this is dual to n equal 4 super Young males at high temperature. So that looks like something that might make sense. But this is definitely the wrong spacetime because it has a temperature. So it's definitely wrong. But we can do two wake rotations. So we're going to take our time, multiply t by I, and turn this into a spatial coordinate. And then we're going to take our y, multiply him by y, and turn this guy into our new time. So we get the very similar spacetime. So we get this thing, this spacetime over here. This f, again, is 1 minus z4 over zm to the 4. And our y is going to have to be periodic. To make sure that we don't have any, to make sure the geometry is smooth at Zm. So over here, we had a nice black brain. And if you go through Z equals Zm, you can go past. And you just go basically inside the black hole. Over here, our geometry actually ends. When you cross the Z equals Zm, there's nothing over that on the other side. And so Z equals Zm is basically the origin in spherical coordinates. It's just the point where the circle around this spherical y coordinate goes to 0. I'm going to expand on the metric a bit. Okay, so we said that y was periodic with period 2 pi times r. So we need to relate this r with the zn that we have to get the right period to make sure everything is smooth. So this is something that we have to do very often. So I'll do it in a bit more general way, because this is useful. And you get a nice formula at the end that you want to remember by heart. And then forever and time you have to calculate periodicity of something, hopefully it's very simple. You don't have to think. So we have a small part of our metric. Looks like f dy squared plus dz squared over f. And what I want is something that looks like a d rho squared over here. And I want some spherical coordinates, right? So I want rho squared times some new coordinate kappa dy, which is going to have the right period. Well, which has period 2 pi over here. Plus. So near z z equals zn, we can Taylor expand our function f. So f looks like f at zm plus the derivative plus a bunch of other stuff. And conveniently, our f disappears as zm. So our function looks like just f prime times this. And this over here, this is just some number, right? So we're just Taylor expanding, and everything will be simple. So the first thing we want to do is we want to find this coordinate rho. Right, so you define d rho squared equals dz squared over f. And so d rho by dz is 1 over square root of f.
I'm not sure. I guess I just don't know what you mean by this first line you've written on the board.
Over here?
Yeah.
So it doesn't, if you do a conformal transformation, it won't affect the periodicity.
Okay.
So you don't.
So you can, yeah, you're just getting the simple conformal factor. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Alternatively, without invoking conformal blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's just a common factor, and
right.
Near z equals zm, it'll just be a factor that's just
okay.
There in front of everything.
Right, so you have this d rho dz is 1 over root f, and so you can integrate that to find your rho, right? So that's just 1 over square root of, well, integral 1 over root f dz. And so that's 1 over root of f prime, which was this number, times the integral dz over root z minus zm. And so your rho is just 2 root z minus zm divided by square root of f prime. So we have a rho. We can plug this back into our first metric over here. So yeah, I have this f dy squared plus dz squared over f. So now that's f dy squared plus d rho squared. But I can write my f in terms of d rho dz. So that's 1 over rho prime squared times dy squared plus d rho squared. And then I can do something silly and multiply this by rho squared and divide it by rho squared. So it'll be rho squared times 1 over rho squared rho prime squared dy squared plus d rho squared. And then you say, well, this looks a bit silly. It looks kind of like this form I have here. And hopefully this thing is actually a constant. So you calculate it, and you find that rho squared rho prime squared, I have my rho over here in terms of f prime, I have rho prime in terms of f, and I have f in terms of f prime. So I can write everything in terms of the derivative of f at the horizon. So this is just 4 times z minus zm over f times f prime. And then using the relation at the top, this is just 4 over f prime squared. So this is just a constant, which is great. And so we can just call this kappa squared, or 1 over kappa squared, so the way I did it. And so basically, we found our metric in this form, and this kappa is just f prime of at the horizon divided by 2. So in our case, this is 2 over zm. Then you want the periodicity. So you say, well, this coordinate kappa y has period 2 pi. And so y has period 2 pi over kappa. So that gives us this coordinate r must be zm over 2. So that relates this R that we had before on the CFT with the value of Zm for the geometry that we want. Are people happy with this? Okay, so we have our metric and our geometry. And the first hint to say that this might work is, well, normally you associate this coordinate Z with an energy scale. And so essentially what we've done right now is we put some sort of a wall or a big bound in the IR in our spacetime. So if you ask, well, what's the lowest energy state in my spacetime? Well, it can't be zero because I removed all the zero part. The lowest energy is going to be at energy Zm, whatever that means on the field theory. So automatically, we expect that we have some sort of a mass gap in this geometry. And so we expect that we have a confining theory and all the nice things that we hope. Are there any questions? No.
Is equal to one of the rows.
Sorry, which port are we talking about?
The middle one now with the second to last line.
Okay.
You said one over rho prime squared, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that the question?
That was easy.
So I'm just saying one over rho prime squared because my F was equal to 1 over rho prime squared from this line just above here. D rho dz is 1 over root f.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else?
That's a good point.
All right, so we spent a lot of time talking about this spacetime, but we've actually seen it before. Let's just refresh our memory a little bit. Calculate a minimal, or at least draw a picture of a minimal surface, because I'm not actually going to calculate it. So we've already seen the spacetime when looking at quark antiquark potential, and we did it in vacuum ADS, and we also did it in this spacetime, and we talked about confinement a while ago. So to refresh everyone's memory, we have this boundary of ADS. You put a quark somewhere here. You put an antiquark somewhere over there. And basically what you find is that the minimal surface between the two looks like the potential between the quark and the antiquark. So in our case, we don't just have vacuum ADS, what we do is we introduce some cutoff over here, Zm. And we cut off all the bottom region of our spacetime. And so now the minimal surface can't dip all the way through. And so it'll look kind of like this and then something like that. And so you expect that, OK, well, the area of the surface is going to look be more or less like this distance over here, which is proportional to the distance between the quarks. And so you expect that your potential looks like L, and therefore you have a confining potential. So again, this is telling us that we're on the promising path to calculate stuff about confinement for QCD. OK, let's actually look at the mass spectrum now. So basically the goal, Ross, are you happy?
Magic. How about everybody else? Is everybody else happy?
Who is unhappy, but doesn't want to say it?
Well, what if ZM was much lower? You're kind of relying here on the fact that ZM is kind of close to the boundary.
Yeah, but ZM is related to my R, and my R is small.
What happens if the separation between the quarks is small? Is, say, much smaller than R, your capital R.
Well, then potential will be proportional to L. It doesn't really affect the confinement. All we're saying is that if they're far away, then potential has to be infinite. Does anyone have to be with that? Okay, so so we want to calculate the spectrum of glue ball masses on the field theory, and there's a lot of different modes and different types of glue balls, or different. Yeah, modes, I guess, is the best word. So we're going to look at the operator trace of F squared, which for us is going to be a massless free scalar field propagating in ADS. So that's going to be the simplest calculation. So what we're going to say is that the mass of this glue ball operator is going to be somehow related to the motion of our field. I don't know exactly how soon. In ADS, so all the calculation we need to do is just solve a free Klein-Gordon equation for a massless particle in that spacetime that we have. So that sounds pretty simple. We're going to take the ansatz that our field is some function of z. Times a wave, and then we're going to take the vector k, the transverse momentum to be zero, just because that's going to be the mode that you expect to have the smallest mass anyways. We just want to show that there's a mass gap and calculate the lowest mass, so we should be fine doing that. I guess it has to be. It has to be somewhere, so I guess so.
Okay.
Really, I told us now kind of forget about why and just consider the one in effective theory.
Yeah, so I mean, the way of saying this would be, let's say ky is very small or zero. So I'm setting all of k to zero anyways.
Yeah, no, it's just in principle there's a Fourier mode or whatever way on y, but you're right. At the end of the day, the lowest mode just has no or is constant around that.
Right. Okay. Now the question is, what's the capital mass or the mass of the gluon? So what I have over here is some free scalar field. I'm setting k to be 0. So basically, I have a free field which is massless moving in the z direction. If I look on the boundary, my degree of freedom, I don't have the z coordinate anymore. And I set this k to be 0. So I have basically some sort of stationary state. I have a particle on the boundary, and he's just sitting around. And so if this is my boundary four vector, then I have this n squared is just minus k squared usually, but I set this vector k to be 0, and this is just omega squared. So whatever frequency at which my three-scalar field is moving around in the bulk, that's going to give me the mass of my blue ball in my field theory. So what we're trying to show is that if the frequency is 0, that there's no solution which works, which is normalizable. And we want to show that the omega squared has a discrete spectrum. Is anyone unhappy? Yeah. All right, so we throw this into our Klein-Gordon equation. This equation, we have two boundary conditions. The first one is we're going to demand that our wave function be normalizable. So here the problem doesn't look like it right now, but it'll look like it more in a few minutes, is basically just doing a Schrodinger type equation. So all we're trying to do is we have some, or we will have a potential soon, with a differential equation. And right, so basically it's like you're looking for some wave function given a potential which has to be normalizable, it has to die off at infinity. So remember that our field phi as z goes to 0 looked like, in our case it's massless, so it looked like some constant plus something times phi to the 4. Right, so you had this. Z to the 4. So you had this relation delta minus d, so 4, is equal to m squared, which is 0. And so we have a constant and a z to the 4 term. So if we demand that first condition is normalizable, that means that we're going to demand that this thing vanish, and we're only going to pick out one of the two modes at the boundary. The second boundary condition is that z equals zm on the other side. We're going to demand that the derivative of the function at zm be equal to 0. So this is just because zm is like the origin in spherical coordinates. So if you have a smooth function and it's going through the origin, it has to be flat. Because otherwise your integral phi squared will diverge. Just like in quantum mechanics, right? You don't want to have a wave function which is like exponential at infinity or whatever.
What you said is true, but one might also say that one of the things we might have learned in our earlier lectures is that when we look at phi near the boundary, there are these two independent solutions. One corresponds to turning on an operator. The other is like an expectation value. And so if I had phi equals a constant, that would represent something else in the field theory. It would say not that I've got an excitation to produce some kind of expectation value, but rather that I've actually to form the field theory at the boundary. But
right. So if you have this field, then how would you employ some vacuum expectations?
How would you what?
Maybe I'm just naive here, but if you're assuming that z goes to 0, well, in this kind of case, phi will go to 0.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that this phi will always, oh my God. Yeah, I'm confused. I was just thinking that could you have like non-zero vacuum expectation values for pi itself? So that's not that reasonable question for that.
No, you could have phi equals a constant, but if you, so there was this story about the two coefficients, what he's calling constant and capital A, being related to a coefficient of an operator in the Lagrangian or an expectation value of the dual operator in the field theory. So if I turn on that constant, what I'm doing is I'm reforming the boundary theory, whereas the other one is just saying that I've got an excitation or I've got an expectation value. I'm in a state where there's an expectation value of the dual operator. And so when I'm talking about a glue ball, that's an excitation, or I'm producing a new state. I'm not deforming the theory. I'm not changing the Lagrangian. So in this particular problem, he doesn't want that constant to be turned on.
Yeah, we've got some nice sources here. So basically, A looks like the expectation value of our operator. And I even have the references here, so I might as well write that. So if you want to learn all about that, that's from the Klebanoff and Witten paper that I talked about recently. It was so that's angle 5104. And there's also another story that's interesting, but I don't want to tell here. That if you calculate some retarded Riggs function for your boundary theory, it's going to look like A over this constant that I wrote here. And so the story is that if I have a normalizable mode in my bulk, that means I have a pole in my propagator, which means I found a state that was on shell and so on. And so this is a bit more recent. 205.51, if any of you are very interested. All right, so we have some wave equation. We have some boundary conditions. And let's notice a few things. All right, so we're going to take this equation here. I'm going to multiply by root g on both sides. So I'm going to move this guy on this term. Then I'm going to multiply by phi. And then I'm going to integrate the whole thing and integrate the second term by parts. So that's a lot of words, but it's actually a lot simpler once I write it down. So we have writing the wrong equation here. So I'm going to have the left-hand side of my equation is going to look like the integral omega squared times the integral of the norm of phi squared. And then the right-hand side is going to look like this. So the reason I want to do this is because the question that we're trying to find is, or at least what I'd like to show, is that omega squared has to be strictly positive, right? That omega squared can't be zero, therefore we have a mass gap, so we're happy. So this thing is positive, and it's not equal to zero unless my field vanishes. So this is some positive number. This is also obviously some positive number. And everything is finite. And so therefore, omega squared is just the ratio of two finite positive numbers. And so I have that omega squared has to be strictly positive. that make any sense? So this is greater than zero and less than infinity. So is this. And so my omega squared is a strictly positive number, so we have a mass gap. The person or? Right, so it comes from this equation here. So I move this thing on the other side. Then I multiply it by root g. And then I multiply it by phi. So now you get the left-hand side. And now the right-hand side, you integrate. So on the right-hand side, you don't quite get the right thing yet. But if you integrate it by parts, you do. Yeah, so that's where the minus sign shows up.
Should probably also not drop the absolute value of b0, 0.
Okay.
Well, it's multiplying the omega squared term.
Yeah, actually, I dropped the entire system.
As you're integrating a rule space.
Yeah, well, yeah, like from Zm to 0.
Okay.
Anyone not totally happy? Okay, so that's the first thing that we notice. We have a mass gap. Let's notice something else. We have we have our second order ODE, and so you can write it as this term Liouville problem. So that means it's a good old quantum mechanics particle in a box kind of problem. We have our two boundary conditions. We're demanding that the wave function vanishes at z equals 0. And we're demanding that, well, we have our geometry is fixed on the other side at z equals zm. And therefore, automatically, we're going to have a discrete spectrum of eigenvalues. So did that make any sense? Right, so we'll see in about 15 seconds.
That first boundary condition, if you go to 0, is just the statement that the phi should vanish at 0, right?
Yeah.
OK. Then it's a good old-fashioned
story. Yeah, so it's really good old-fashioned quantum mechanics. You have some complicated potential, which I'll write soon for some Schrodinger equation. And then you have some boundary conditions, which will pick out that you have only discrete spectrum of eigenvalues. Right, so if you compare it to what would happen in pure ADS, to contrast, in pure ADS, you have oscillating solutions. So your field, if I solve the Klein-Gordon equation in ADS, I get a bunch of Bessel functions. And so my phi goes to cos of z as z goes to infinity. And so if you have an oscillating solution at infinity, then you're going to have a continuous spectrum of eigenvalues. And that's why none of this really applies for pure ADS. So what's really special in our case is really because we cut off our geometry at some z equals zm, then our eigenvalues are going to have to be discrete. Okay, so let's see how we go about actually computing these masses. And so we have our equation, which is here. So if I rewrite the equation that we have in terms of z and the actual metric, we have omega squared phi is minus 1 over z to the d times the derivative of z to the d f dz phi. So this is the boundary condition that we want to solve. And then you can do a few change of variables. So you define zm over z is 1 plus e to the y. So you introduce some new coordinate y. And you do this so that as z goes to 0, y goes to infinity. And if z goes to zm, y goes to minus infinity. Should be 4.
Is it 4 or 3?
Let's see. It's 4. It's a bulk space dimension, including the S1. So D is 4. So I mean, when we do D, I never use the fact that that the S1 was very small or something. It's always in the y coordinate is in the metric. So when I write D, I really mean what I always call D. So that would be 4. Is something wrong with that?
Well, one problem is that I'd expect the square root of minus d to have inverse powers of z, given your metric up there. But I really think it's just the dimension of the theory, the Yang-Mills theory, because meaning without the circle direction in it.
Yeah, I think so too.
Do you see mathematically at all? Why?
Well, there's this factor of 1 over z squared in front of the metric. So that's all I have to follow. So the square root of minus g is going to have, you know, 1 over z to the dimension of your bulk space time. Then gzz inverse carries a factor of z squared.
Yeah.
And so I think that knocks it from the dimension of the bulk space time minus 2. And so
right.
That's really
yeah,
the
right.
dimension of the, you know, where the Yang knows. But I really think it's inverse power, it's not positive power.
The first one or the second one?
Inside the, yeah, that.
Like this guy should be a
minus. And so the one outside would be plus.
So this from the Grivian, I think he had one of the D's wrong. And I thought I had to try to fix it. But anyway, so you plug your Kai coordinate, you get something that looks like this. But some powers of z. So you introduce a new coordinate y.
So instead of going from 0 to zm, which is inconvenient, now we'll go from minus infinity to infinity independently of zm. So that's good. And we're also going to rewrite our field phi to be some new function of y times another function of y. I'm going to read my phi to be some beta of y times chi of y. And this trick is just so I can rewrite this differential equation in terms of the Schrodinger equation for chi. So if I do this and then I play around, then your differential equation looks like something times chi two derivatives plus something else times one derivative plus a constant term, well, plus a linear term. right? So this is some complicated, it has some beta of y over here, and you extracted all the chi's.
I think it's some product of power of the two functions. If you have that equation with whatever arbitrary coefficient, say a of z multiplying dz, b of z times dz phi, then beta would be some product of a times b to some power. I think that's the general way of reducing that kind of equation to the one that you're writing there. I was just saying that because I thought it might be a little bit more illuminating, because normally it would seem weird to introduce a product of two functions that are functions of the same variable.
Yeah,
so in this case, the trick is just because this beta is just a product of the two coefficients in that equation.
Or
it's a general trick.
Whatever we'll call
it.
The way that I'll do it here is that, so you have something here, something there, something here, and you say, but what I really want is something that looks like the Schrodinger equation, which is something times two derivative plus, and then there's only this term, but there's no chi prime term in the Schrodinger equation. So this is some differential equation for beta, right? So this has some betas, it has some beta primes in it, and if I solve this differential equation, whatever I have here equals zero, I can find my function beta in here, and then I get something that looks like Schrodinger equation. So after I do all this magic, you get minus chi prime prime plus some potential is equal to zero. And does anyone want to see the potential?
Can you draw a picture?
I can draw a picture. So, let's see, so what you find is that, so this is the y-axis over here, I have z equals zero. Y equals minus infinity, I have z equals zm all the way at infinity. What you find is that, first of all, the potential is positive on the right-hand side. And so that tells you why you have a nice decaying solution at the end, and that's why we can have our next normalizable mode. So that looks like a particle in a box over here. And then he loops and then he asymptotes to zero on the left. So more things to notice. So like I said, V is positive as z goes to zero, so as y goes to infinity. So when I draw this potential, the potential is a function of omega, or at least the way I drew it. So this is the way you write this equation over here. This is a particle of energy zero, and the potential has the omega fit inside it. So it's basically V minus E. So to draw this, I had to pick some value of omega. If you pick your omega squared to be less than or equal to zero, what you find is that the potential actually stays positive. It looks something like this. I'm not sure what it does on the right. But basically, when your omega squared is negative, your potential is positive everywhere. So you have potential is larger than your energy, and you don't have any bound states. So that tells you that you definitely do have a mass gap. Yeah?
That first equation you wrote in this section.
This?
Shouldn't there be an overall minus sign, and shouldn't the f's cancel in the determinant?
The f's?
Yeah. But shouldn't there be a minus sign for from taking the omega squared phi to the other side?
There was a minus that you got erased accidentally when he was changing the power.
Like that's how all these eigenvalue equations go, minus the mass squared phi.
Yeah, it looks like there
probably
there was a minus there before.
There was.
And then you crunch it out when you change it from one over.
Oh, over here?
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay, that's good. Right, so we have our potential. So on one hand, we're happy that it's, it tells us that we have a mass gap, because whenever our mass is negative, the potential is greater than zero, so we can't have any bound particles. And now we actually want to compute the solutions for this. So the best way is to just do it numerically.
Exactly. A sat greater than square hours.
All right, so let's look at numbers. So this is just solving Schrödinger equation, so we're very good at doing that. And then there's people, they do lattice QCD. And that's much more difficult than what we're doing here. But somehow, they're also able to get some numbers. So we're going to compute some stuff. So the most convenient thing to calculate is ratios between masses. That way, so if I were to just calculate masses the way I did, and I solve my equation, I could write everything in terms in units of my energy scale of that circle that I have. And either I would have to be very, very careful when I compare it to lattice QCD, which might be dangerous. But generally, one thing you can do is you just look at ratios between the different modes and compare, because that's going to be dimensionless. So we're going to look at the first two. So lattice QCD, you have 1.506, 1.520. So these two are pretty similar. And ADS-CFT is close, but outside the error bounds. And same thing here, 1.91, 1.92. I imagine the, I don't know, put a big N and see if it converges somewhere.
Just the one.
I don't know anything about lattice. Okay. That sounds like a thing.
No, I don't know anything about lattice.
That's probably N equal 20 million.
N
no, I think they're much more, I think they do like.
I imagine that they look at many of them and make sure the number converges.
Yeah, no, that part was right, but I'm also not an expert, but I don't think they get past like 10 or something like that. But they do extrapolate.
But like this N is not the like.
No, that's
it's the rank of the gauge group.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the large N
right.
limit. N,
right.
Which is why we look at large N here. So it mostly works. I don't know what the. Conclusion is, I don't know if Rob, you have any good words about how happy this is.
What are 1, 2,
and 3?
1, 2, and 3. So in your M's, you have masses for 1, 2, and 3. So what are they? I'm not sure.
So here, I think they're just the first three states in my problem here. So for my glue balls, it would be the first three eigenstates.
So, oh, okay. Right.
Do you want them in? I mean, I have them in more standard notation, but I'm not sure what it means. But this is N plus plus, and plus plus star, and then plus plus star star.
Did I say that again?
So, they're N plus plus, and plus plus star, plus plus star star. They call them that, but I'm not sure what that's
okay.
supposed to mean.
So they're really glue balls that I associate with that single operator trace up score. They're not
Yeah, all of them are trace F squared.
Okay. Okay. And yeah. Okay.
Yeah, those are pretty old. From 98.
No, because I know another thing you do is you consider other operators, other field equations, and they're different. But you wouldn't have star and star.
Yeah. So these are, I guess, the first most naive ones. And then what people do is they look at different operators and then they call those like m minus minus or something. And I'm not sure exactly what they're looking at, but then they get different types of modes and different particles and CFD and so on. Okay, let's quickly talk about QCD in four dimensions. Right, so this is all great now. We calculate global masses and we find its confinement and mass gap and all that stuff. But everything that we did was for three-dimensional QCD. And that's not what we actually care about. We want to look for something in four-dimensional QCD. So I'm not going to do it, but just to write out what you actually would do. So three-dimensional QCD, we did start with D3 brains. And then you had your theory was type 2B on ADS5 plus S5. And then we played our ADS-CFT game and calculated a bunch of stuff. For QCD4, you want to start with M5 brains, so P equals 5 brains in N theory. And that's on ADS 7 process 4. So in this case, you have two extra dimensions that you need to compactify on the QCD side. You have, one more dimension. So instead of compactifying just one dimension like we did, you'd have to do it for two different dimensions. On the Yang-Mills side, on the gravity side, pretty much everything that we did stays the same, except that instead of starting in ADS5, you start in ADS7. But that's really the only difference. You have a similar kind of black brain, some of these ones change, but yeah.
It's maybe a naive question, but superficially it would seem that maybe you would want to start with P equals 4 in type 2A, right? Wouldn't that be the natural generalization of
Yeah, I think some people do that. And I'm not.
Going to theory, but...
That was Edward's choice, and okay. I don't know. People lately also,
but
people, I've seen the both, and I'm not sure.
But if you start with that's why, because it was Edward did it first,
okay.
Or Witten did it first, and that's where he started. But if you do that first compactification, you compactify one direction, then exactly what is it that comes out? It's nothing but the type 2A theory. And the D4 brain background. So.
Okay, cool. I think I was just wondering.
Yeah, I think he picked that because.
These as opposed to just.
Yeah, I think he did it because this way you actually start with.
It sounds more fancy.
a supersymmetric conformal theory.
I think he may have been thinking that I really want to start with a theory that I know is defined in the UV.
Okay.
Whereas the.
Yeah.
The D4.
I think, yeah.
The story is a little bit more confusing, but what you do, you uplift M theory.
Anyone have any questions? Okay, so I think I'm done. Yeah, I'll be done. Anyone have questions before I run away?
So compactifying a dimension, like the unique way to introduce it, like mass scale to your conformal theory. Like the zeroth order problem that we have is we want a theory with scales, but we know how to deal with conformal theories. So like we compactify the dimension, consider the dimension that you're using. Is there not?
Well, it probably isn't the unique way. I mean, I can probably just add an operator with a scale or something to the theory, and, you know, I imagine. So my guess is that this is the most naive way that works well, especially in ADS-CFT. You want to do something just to your geometry and not start adding a new field or a weird coupling or something.
So the message is like this does sort of work because you do get confinement.
Yeah.
I think it's also, I mean, it's, in some sense it's unique, but it's kind of looking under the lamppost in that it's the one way we know to do it where everything's under control.
Okay.
Like, if I look at what he studies, his solution, it's really just a solution of Einstein's equations, and the curvatures are small everywhere, and they, you know.
Right, so it's the tractable thing.
Right. There might be other ways, but... Or,
that doesn't
give
us much, because it's just as non-perturbative as DPC in the first place.
Yeah. But I have a question. Are you going to talk about at all about the shortcomings of this approach?
I was not, no.
There are none.
I'm a very optimistic person.
You have a couple minutes. Do you want to mention any?
What can I ask you?
What if I calculate these eigenvalues over there, you get a mass. But a mass means it has a scale. So what's the mass, roughly?
Oh, well, it's... Is that a shortcoming?
Well, no, I'm asking you a question.
Okay.
It leads into
right,
it.
Right, so we have our... geometry, so z goes from z equals 0 to z equals zm. And so you imagine that most of your states would live at z equals mn. So you imagine that your energy will look like 1 over z, so 1 over r should be the mass of the lowest lying states. Again, that's the only scale you have. So.
There you go. That's another way of saying
it. But that relates to...
There's only one scale in the problem, and it's R. And all of these glue ball masses come in at 1 over R. But what we know is that there's all sorts of... In the field theory, you gave a nice discussion, but we know that there's all sorts of interesting other physics at that scale, 1 over R. There are fermions. There are scalars. And so there's... You haven't separated the scales, and so it's a these glue ball masses, I shouldn't really think of them as glue balls in just Yang Mill, because they're coming in at exactly the same scale where I know there's new physics in the field theory. And so that's why Witten didn't get the Clay Prize or the Millennium Prize or whatever. And so that's really, actually, in general, that's an issue with these kinds of attempts, is trying to decouple or get a separation of scale. I think, I don't want to be pessimistic. Of course, ADS-CFT is the most wonderful thing known to mankind, but this really isn't...
even just these numbers are not. Even if it's just a first level thing, they're not perfect.
But it does give you a remarkable new way. I mean, you have this geometric picture now, where you to describe confinement in some theory, even if it isn't just the angles. So if there are no more questions, let's thank Alex.
Okay.